Cecily Voss stood in the Duke of Ashworth's study for 4 full minutes. No one offered her a seat. No one offered her a greeting. The butler had shown her in with the same expression he reserved for tradesmen and tax collectors, and the Duke himself had not yet looked up from the papers spread across his desk. Papers she recognized, even from across the room, because her solicitor had sent copies of them to her office in London 3 weeks ago. She knew exactly how much debt was buried in those pages. She knew exactly how many creditors were circling. She knew, to the penny, what it would cost to make all of it disappear. She had not yet decided whether she would. The letter had arrived on a Tuesday. Not to Cecily directly. That would have required someone at Ashworth House to know her name, which no one did, but to her solicitor, Mr. Aldous Prynne, who had forwarded it with a brief note of his own tucked inside. They are looking for a quiet investor, someone discreet, someone with means. I told them I knew of a party who might be interested. I did not tell them the party was a woman. I thought it best. Cecily had read the letter twice, set it down, and looked out the window of her London office for a long moment. Then she had written back, "I'll go myself." Mr. Prynne had not replied, which meant he was either relieved or horrified. With Mr. Prynne, it was often difficult to tell the difference. The journey from London to Ashworth took 4 hours by carriage, and Cecily spent most of it watching the countryside flatten into the gray monotony of late autumn. The estate, when it finally appeared through the trees, was exactly as she had expected, grand in the way that things are grand when they are slowly losing the battle against time. The stonework needed pointing. 2 of the upper windows had been boarded. The gardens were not unlovely, but they had the look of gardens that had been told to manage themselves. She had seen it before, in 12 other estates belonging to 12 other families who had confused dignity with solvency for 1 generation too many. The carriage stopped at the front steps. The butler who appeared at the door looked at her, then at the carriage, then at her again, taking in, she supposed, the quality of her coat, which was excellent, and the absence of a male companion, which was apparently disqualifying, and said, with great politeness and very little warmth, that the tradesman's entrance was around the side. Cecily had looked at him for a moment. "I am not a tradesman," she said pleasantly. "No, madam," he agreed, in a tone that suggested the distinction was not as meaningful as she seemed to believe. She followed him through the front door anyway. The study was on the ground floor, at the end of a corridor lined with portraits of men who all shared the same jaw and the same expression, the particular combination of confidence and entitlement that seemed to be handed down through certain families, along with the title and the silver. Cecily walked past them without hurrying. She had grown up around men who looked like that. She had learned early that the expression was often the only inheritance left. The butler opened the study door, announced her as a Miss Voss, Your Grace, from London, and withdrew. The Duke of Ashworth did not look up. He was younger than she had expected, perhaps 32 or 33, with dark hair that needed cutting and the kind of face that might have been considered handsome if it weren't currently arranged into an expression of profound preoccupation. He was reading, or pretending to read, a document that Cecily was fairly certain was a letter from his primary creditor, a firm called Hartwell and Sons with offices on Fleet Street. She knew the firm. She had bought it 8 months ago. She stood. She waited. The clock on the mantelpiece ticked through 4 minutes, she counted, without making it obvious that she was counting, and the Duke did not look up, did not speak, did not gesture toward the chair that sat empty on the other side of his desk. Cecily looked at the chair. She looked at the Duke. Then she pulled the chair out herself, sat down, folded her hands in her lap, and waited for him to finish pretending he hadn't noticed her arrive. When he finally looked up, there was a brief flicker of something across his face, surprise, she thought, or perhaps irritation, before he arranged it back into the smooth, composed expression of a man who was accustomed to controlling every room he entered. "Miss Voss," he said, "you've come about the investment opportunity." It was not a question. It was barely even an acknowledgement. It was the voice of a man who had already decided what she was and what she was worth, and was prepared to be patient about it for as long as the meeting required. Cecily smiled. "I have," she said. She did not tell him, yet, what the investment opportunity actually was. She did not tell him who had sent her. She did not tell him that the letter on his desk, the one from Hartwell and Sons, the one that had clearly been keeping him up at night, had been written, ultimately, on her instructions. There would be time for that. For now, she simply smiled and let him believe he was the one in control of the room. He would not believe it for long. The Duke laid the document face down on his desk. It was a small gesture, almost unconscious, the kind a man makes when he does not want a stranger to see what he has been reading. Cecily noted it without comment. She had already read every word on that page. She had, in fact, approved the wording herself. "I'll be direct," he said, which in Cecily's experience meant he intended to be anything but. "Ashworth is a profitable estate with temporary cash flow difficulties. We are looking for a short-term private arrangement, discreet, straightforward, with a fair return for the right investor." Cecily nodded slowly, as though she were hearing this for the first time. "Temporary," she repeated. "Yes." "How temporary?" He picked up a different document, prepared in advance, she noticed, which meant he had rehearsed this, and slid it across the desk toward her. She let it sit there for a moment before reaching for it. The figure at the top was the amount he needed. The figure at the bottom was what he was offering in return. Both figures were wrong. The first was too low. She knew the real debt was nearly 40% higher than what he was admitting to. The second was too high, a desperate man's offer, generous in a way that revealed exactly how little room he had left to negotiate. She read it carefully. She took her time. She let him watch her read it. "This is a considerable sum," she said finally. "It is a considerable estate," he replied. There it was, the particular pride of a man who had inherited something magnificent and was only now beginning to understand what it cost to keep it. She had seen that pride before, too. It was, in her experience, the most expensive thing such men owned. "May I ask," she said, setting the document down, "how many other investors you've approached?" Something moved behind his eyes. "That isn't relevant." Which meant several, and none of them had said yes. "Of course," she said pleasantly. She reached into the leather case beside her chair. She had set it down herself, since no one had offered to take it, and produced her own document, thicker than his, bound with a dark ribbon. She placed it on the desk and slid it toward him with the same unhurried motion he had used. He looked at it without picking it up. "What is this?" "My assessment of the estate," she said. "I had it prepared before I came." Now he picked it up. She watched him read the first page, then the second. On the third page, she knew which paragraph it was because she had written it herself. His jaw tightened almost imperceptibly. "Where did you get these figures?" he said. His voice was still controlled, but only just. "I have good solicitors," she said. "These figures are," he stopped, started again. "Some of this information is private." "Yes," she agreed. He looked at her then, really looked at her, for the first time since she had walked into the room. She held his gaze without difficulty. She had been preparing for this meeting, in one way or another, for the better part of a year. "Who sent you?" he said. It was the same question she had expected. She had prepared three different answers, depending on how the meeting went. She chose the simplest one. "A friend of your father's," she said. He was quiet for a moment. My father has been dead for 6 years. I know, she said. He was a friend of my family as well. She offered nothing more. He waited, clearly expecting more, and when it didn't come, his expression shifted into something she recognized as the earliest stage of frustration. The moment when a man who is accustomed to being the most informed person in the room begins to realize he is not. He set her document down. He straightened it against the edge of the desk with great precision, which told her his hands needed something to do. The sum you've outlined here, he said carefully, you are prepared to offer this. I came prepared to discuss it, she said. That is not the same thing. No, she agreed, it isn't. He leaned back in his chair. He was recalibrating, she could see it, trying to determine what kind of person she was and what she actually wanted, which were the right questions, only he was starting on them far too late. Miss Voss, he said, and his voice had taken on a different quality, now smoother, more deliberate, the voice he used, she suspected, when he wanted something. I don't wish to be indelicate, but a private financial arrangement of this scale, between a single woman and... A duke, she supplied. An estate, he corrected, with a slight emphasis that was meant to remind her she was speaking to a title, not merely a man. It would raise questions, about the nature of the arrangement, about your position. Cecily looked at him for a long, quiet moment. Your Grace, she said, I have been raising questions about my position since I was 19 years old. I find I have stopped minding. He blinked. It was, she thought, probably the first time in recent memory that anyone in this room had said something he wasn't prepared for. She let it sit. Then she reached across the desk, picked up her own document, and began to place it back in her case with the same unhurried calm with which she had produced it. What are you doing? He said. I have another appointment in the village, she said. I don't wish to be late. We haven't finished. We haven't started, she said pleasantly. You offered me figures that don't reflect your actual situation. I showed you figures that do. You then suggested that my reputation was a more pressing concern than your debt. She fastened the clasp on her case. I don't think we are quite ready to have a productive conversation, Your Grace. Perhaps another time. She stood. He stood too, reflexively, which she suspected surprised him as much as it surprised her. An automatic courtesy from a man who had, until 30 seconds ago, been questioning her suitability to sit in his study. Miss Voss. Good afternoon, Your Grace. She was at the door when he said it. The figures in your document, his voice had lost its smoothness. All of them, were they accurate? She paused with her hand on the door frame. She did not turn around. Everyone, she said. She left him standing behind his desk. In a room full of papers, he now understood less than he had an hour ago. With a document she had deliberately left behind, tucked under the corner of his inkwell, where he would find it when she was already gone. It contained one additional page he hadn't seen. The page with her real offer. The village inn was called the Heart and Crown, and it was the kind of place that had been serving the same families for 4 generations, and knew better than to ask questions about the 5th. Cecily had taken a room there the night before, arriving quietly, signing the register with her solicitor's address rather than her own, and requesting that her meals be brought up rather than taken in the dining room. Not because she was ashamed of being seen, because she was not yet ready to be recognized. In a village this close to Ashworth, there was always the possibility of being recognized. She sat now at the small writing desk by the window, her case open beside her, a cup of tea cooling at her elbow, and looked out at the gray afternoon without really seeing it. The meeting had gone almost exactly as she had expected. Almost. She had not expected him to stand when she left. It was such a small thing. an automatic thing, probably, bred into him from boyhood, the reflex of a man raised to observe certain courtesies whether he felt them or not. He likely hadn't even noticed he'd done it. But she had noticed. She pulled a small leather journal from the inner pocket of her case. It was old, the cover worn soft at the corners, the pages thick with years of handling. It had belonged to her father. She did not write in it. She only carried it. On the inside cover, in her father's handwriting, precise and small, the handwriting of a man who had learned to be careful with space, because paper was expensive when he was young, were two lines. Ashworth took everything, give his son a chance anyway. Cecily had read those lines so many times that she no longer needed to look at them. She looked at them anyway. Her father, Thomas Voss, had come to England from Prussia at the age of 22 with £40, excellent arithmetic, and the particular stubbornness of a man who has decided he will not fail. By the time Cecily was born, he had built a small trading concern into something considerably larger. By the time she was 10, the Voss name meant something in certain circles, not society circles, not the kind that mattered to dukes and their mothers, but the circles where money was actually made and moved and multiplied. By the time she was 14, all of it was gone. Not through any fault of her father's. That was the part that had taken her the longest to understand and then the longest to accept. Thomas Voss had been careful. Thomas Voss had been honest. Thomas Voss had trusted the wrong man. Specifically, he had trusted the 5th Duke of Ashworth, who had borrowed heavily against Voss's assets, made a series of catastrophic investments, and died before the full consequences could reach him, leaving his creditors to sort out the wreckage among themselves. The Voss family had not sorted out well. They had lost the house first, then the business, then, more slowly and more painfully, the particular confidence that comes from knowing you have something solid beneath your feet. Her father had never recovered it, not the money and not the confidence. He had found smaller work, quieter work. He had been grateful for what remained. He had, to the end of his life, refused to speak badly of the late Duke, which Cecily had found, as a young woman, completely maddening. He made mistakes, her father had said once near the end. Men make mistakes. What matters is what we do with ours. He died, Cecily had said. He didn't have to do anything. No, her father had agreed quietly, but his son does, and so do you. She had rebuilt everything herself. Slowly, then quickly, she had her father's arithmetic and considerably more of his stubbornness than anyone had anticipated. She had used her mother's maiden name in business because Voss, in certain London circles, still carried the faint smell of failure, and she had not yet finished proving that it didn't. She had bought Hartwell and Sons not out of strategy. Not initially. She had bought it because it was a good firm at a fair price. It was only afterward, going through the portfolio, that she had found Ashworth's name in the ledgers. She had sat with that discovery for 3 weeks before deciding what to do. What she had decided was, go herself, see what was left of the family that had broken hers, decide in person whether her father's instruction made any sense. Give his son a chance. She closed the journal. The 6th Duke of Ashworth had not offered her a chair. He had questioned her reputation before he had learned her name. He had shown her false figures and expected her to be grateful for the sight of them. And yet, he had stood when she left. Cecily picked up her tea, found it cold, and drank it anyway. She was still sitting there an hour later when the knock came at her door. Not the innkeeper, not the girl who brought meals, but a boy of perhaps 12, out of breath, holding a folded note with the Ashworth seal pressed into the wax. She looked at the seal for a moment before she broke it. Inside, in handwriting that was neither precise nor small, the handwriting of a man more accustomed to dictating than writing, were 11 words. Miss Voss, I believe we have more to discuss. Ashworth asterisk. Cecily read it twice. Then she set it on the desk beside her father's journal and looked at the two of them together for a long moment. The old worn leather and the fresh cream paper, the careful handwriting and the careless one, the past and whatever came next. She picked up her pen. She wrote four words on a fresh sheet, folded it, and handed it back to the boy. Tomorrow 10 o'clock, V. She did not write her first name. She had not yet decided whether he had earned it. The invitation arrived at the Heart and Crown on Thursday morning. Not for Cecily. For a Mrs. Aldgate, the wife of a local magistrate, staying two rooms down the corridor, who received it with great excitement and spent the better part of breakfast telling anyone who would listen that the Duke of Ashworth was hosting a ball on Saturday evening, his first in 3 years, and that the entire county was expected to attend. Cecily, sitting at the corner table with her tea and her correspondence, listened without appearing to listen. She had not received an invitation. She had not expected one. Their second meeting, the one she had agreed to on Tuesday, the one she had spent Wednesday preparing for, had gone differently than the first. The Duke had been more careful this time, more measured. He had offered her tea, which she accepted. He had not offered her an apology, which she noted. He had asked better questions and listened more carefully to the answers. And at the end of 2 hours, he had said, with the particular stiffness of a man making an effort he finds uncomfortable, that he would like to continue the conversation. Cecily had said she would consider it. She had not said yes. She had not said no. She had gone back to her room and written a very long letter to Mr. Prynne in London, detailing every exchange, every hesitation, every moment where the Duke had almost said something honest and then retreated back behind his title. Mr. Prynne had replied by return post. You are being more patient than the situation requires. Come home. Send a solicitor. She had not replied. And now there was a ball. She found out the rest of it from Mrs. Aldgate, who was the kind of woman who found silence in other people an invitation to fill it. The ball was, by all accounts, a considerable undertaking for an estate that had recently had its east wing closed for the winter. There were to be 200 guests. There was to be an orchestra from London. There was to be, Mrs. Aldgate added with a meaningful lowering of her voice, a very deliberate collection of eligible young women from the county's best families. They say he needs to marry money, Mrs. Aldgate confided, with the cheerful frankness of someone discussing weather. The estate is in trouble. Everyone knows it, though no one says so. How unfortunate, Cecily said. For the girls, I mean, Mrs. Aldgate clarified, marrying into trouble, though of course a dukedom is a dukedom. Cecily smiled and returned to her correspondence. She was not surprised by the ball. She was not surprised by the eligible young women. She was not even particularly surprised that the Duke, having spent 2 afternoons discussing a serious financial arrangement with a serious woman, had decided to pursue a more traditional solution simultaneously. She was, she discovered, somewhere between amused and something that was not quite hurt, an emotion she examined briefly and set aside, because it was not useful and she had not come here to feel it. She wrote to Mr. Prynne's junior associate, a young man named Fellows who was clever and presentable and owned exactly one good suit. She told him to come to Ashworth on Saturday. She told him what to say when he got there. Fellows arrived on Saturday afternoon, somewhat rumpled from the journey but possessed of the bright-eyed competence that Cecily had always found more valuable than elegance. She met him in the inn's small sitting room, gave him his instructions, handed him a sealed envelope, and sent him up to the house in time for the pre-dinner reception. She herself ordered supper in her room. She sat by the window and watched the carriages go past on the road toward Ashworth, the lights bobbing through the dark, the distant sound of hooves on gravel, the faint drift of music when the wind turned, and she thought about her father, and about the fifth duke, and about the particular cruelty of systems that allowed one man's carelessness to erase another man's life's work. She was still thinking about it when Fellows came back, shortly before midnight, and knocked on her door. "Well," she said. He was trying not to smile, which meant it had gone well. "I delivered the envelope to the Duke directly," he said. "During the supper interval, he read it at the table. And..." "He went rather pale," Fellows said. "Then he excused himself. He was gone for nearly 20 minutes. When he came back, he asked me who I worked for." Fellows paused. "I told him I worked for Miss Voss. He asked which Miss Voss. I said the only one I knew of." Cecily waited. "He asked where you were," Fellows said. "I told him you were otherwise engaged. He asked..." Fellows reached into his coat pocket and produced a folded note. "He asked me to give you this." Cecily took it. The handwriting was less controlled than it had been on Tuesday, less careful. "Why are you not here?" 4 words. No salutation, no signature, just 4 words that told her considerably more than 4 words should. She folded it and set it on the windowsill. "Go and get some sleep," she told Fellows. "We leave for London Monday morning." Fellows hesitated at the door, and the Duke. Cecily looked at the note on the windowsill. "He knows where to find me," she said. She did not sleep well that night. Not because she was troubled exactly, but because something had shifted in a way she hadn't planned for and wasn't entirely sure she could account for. The Duke's 4 words sat in her mind with an insistence that irritated her. "Why are you not here?" "Because you didn't invite me," she thought. "Because you never once considered that you should." She turned the lamp down and lay in the dark and listened to the last of the carriages returning from Ashworth, the music long since silent, the night settling into the particular stillness of the countryside. Tomorrow she would write a proper reply. She would be very professional about it. She fell asleep still composing it, and in the morning she looked at what she had written and crossed out the first 3 versions before she found one she was satisfied with. It was 4 sentences long. The last one said, "I was not invited, Your Grace. I find, however, that I am not yet finished with Ashworth. Whether Ashworth is finished with me remains to be seen." She sent it before she could change her mind. She was halfway to London before she allowed herself to wonder what his face had looked like when he read it. The study at Ashworth House was coldest after midnight. The Duke had known this since childhood, had known it the way you know things that are absorbed through years of living in a place rather than learned all at once. The fire in the east grate never quite reached the far corner where the oldest shelves stood, and the window behind the desk let in a draft that no amount of reglazing had ever fully solved. As a boy, he had found it unpleasant. As a man, he had stopped noticing it. He noticed it tonight. It was past 1 in the morning. The ball had been over for 3 hours. The last carriage had gone. The staff had been dismissed. The house was quiet in the way that large houses are quiet, not silent exactly, but settled into itself, creaking and breathing at its own slow rhythm, indifferent to the man sitting alone in the study with a glass of brandy he hadn't touched and a collection of his father's old ledgers spread across the desk in front of him. He had not planned to look at the ledgers tonight. He had planned, if he was honest, to spend the evening doing what the ball had been designed to help him do, identifying a practical solution to an impractical problem, which was to say, finding a woman of sufficient fortune who was also of sufficient family, who might be persuaded that a dukedom was worth its current complications. He had gone through the motions of it. He had danced the right dances and said the right things and smiled at the right moments. And the whole time, in the back of his mind, with an insistence he found deeply inconvenient, he had been thinking about a woman who was not in the room. "Why are you not here?" He had written it without thinking, had handed it to Fellows before he'd had time to reconsider, and spent the rest of the evening regretting it. Not because it wasn't true, but because it was far too true, and he was not accustomed to his own handwriting betraying him. He had come to the study afterward not with any particular intention, but with the vague restlessness of a man who could not settle, and he had stood in front of the shelves for a long time before he had begun, almost without deciding to, pulling down the ledgers from his father's time. He was not sure what he was looking for. He told himself he was looking for context, for some record of the estate's finances in better years, something that might support the case he needed to make to potential investors, or to Miss Voss, or to both. That was what he told himself. What he was actually doing, if he was honest, was trying to understand how things had gotten so far. His father had not been a careless man. That was the thing that had always troubled him, in the years since the full weight of the inheritance had made itself known. The fifth Duke of Ashworth had been, by every account Callum had ever heard, meticulous, deliberate, not warm, perhaps. Warmth had not been a notable quality in the Ashworth men for several generations, but careful, responsible, the kind of man who checked figures twice and trusted very few people with the ones that mattered. And yet the figures had gone wrong somewhere. Badly, irreversibly wrong. Callum had always assumed it was the investments, a series of ventures in the early 1840s that had performed catastrophically and taken a significant portion of the Ashworth capital with them. He had grown up understanding it as bad luck, more or less. The kind of misfortune that could happen to any man. He was on the fourth ledger, somewhere around 2 in the morning, when he found the name. Voss. It appeared first as a creditor, a modest sum, a short-term arrangement, the kind of quiet private lending that gentlemen sometimes arranged with successful merchants when they needed ready capital and preferred not to involve the banks. The terms were fair. The interest was reasonable. The fifth Duke had signed his name at the bottom in the same hand Callum knew from 100 other documents. He turned the page. Then the next. Then he sat back in his chair and looked at the ceiling for a long moment. The lending had not been modest. Not ultimately. What had started as a short-term arrangement had grown, page by page, year by year, through a series of extensions and amendments and quietly renegotiated terms, into something considerably larger. Thomas Voss, merchant, had extended the fifth Duke of Ashworth a level of credit that was, in retrospect, extraordinary. Not just in size, but in its terms. The extensions had been granted, again and again, without penalty, without the escalating interest rates that any other creditor would have imposed. Thomas Voss had trusted the fifth Duke of Ashworth completely. Callum read on. He read for another hour, and the picture that assembled itself across those pages was not one he had ever been shown, not by his father's solicitors, not by the men who had managed the estate in the years after his father's death, not by anyone. The investments that had failed in part because of capital that should have been Voss's. The losses that had cascaded through the Ashworth accounts in the late 1840s had taken Voss's money with them, not through any deliberate malice, perhaps, but through the particular recklessness of a man who had treated another man's trust as his own resource. Thomas Voss had lost everything. And no one, not the solicitors, not the estate managers, not the sixth Duke of Ashworth who had inherited both the title and the debts, had ever thought to say so. Callum sat with that for a long time. The brandy remained untouched. The fire had died down to embers. The cold from the corner was more pronounced now, and he was aware of it in a way that felt appropriate, that felt, in some obscure way, like the right physical condition for what he was reading. He turned to the last page of the ledger. There was a note there, tucked into the inside back cover, folded small, the paper aged to the color of old cream. his father's handwriting but different from the careful precision of the ledger entries, less controlled, the writing of a man in a state of some agitation. TV has been more than generous, more than I deserved. I mean to make it right when the Hereford venture resolves. I will make it right. The Hereford venture had not resolved. It had been among the worst of the failures. Callum folded the note and held it in his hands for a moment. His father had known. His father had known and had intended to rectify it and had died before he could, and in the chaos of the succession and the reorganization and the years of quietly managing the damage, the name Voss had simply disappeared, slipped out of the accounting, become one of dozens of creditors who had been settled for pennies against what they were owed, or not settled at all. And now a woman named Voss had walked into his study. A woman named Voss who had known the real figures before she arrived, who had produced a document that reflected the true state of the Ashworth accounts with a precision that no outside party should have been able to achieve, who had said, when he asked who sent her, a friend of your father's, and had offered nothing more, who had left before he had thought to ask the right questions. Callum stood up. He went to the window and looked out at the dark grounds, the long avenue of trees, the gate at the end of the drive, the road beyond it that led, eventually, to the village, and to the inn where he had been fairly certain until Monday morning that Miss Voss was still staying. She had left for London. Fellows had told him that, when Callum had sent to the inn on Monday and received a reply from the innkeeper instead of from her. Gone. Bag and writing case and the quiet, self-contained competence that had occupied his study for two afternoons and left a considerable impression for something that had technically resolved nothing. He looked at the note in his hand. I mean to make it right. His father had written those words and never acted on them. Callum set the note on the desk with the care of a man handling something fragile, though the paper was not fragile. It had survived decades already, folded small in the back of a ledger that no one had thought to open. He went to his own writing desk. He took out a fresh sheet. He wrote for a long time, longer than he usually allowed himself, longer than was comfortable, crossing out and starting again in a way that he would not have permitted himself in correspondence with anyone else. He was not accustomed to writing letters he was not sure how to finish. He was not accustomed, in general, to being the less informed person in a situation, and the experience of reading those ledgers had left him with the particular discomfort of a man who has just discovered that the ground he has been standing on is considerably less solid than he believed. He finished the letter near 4 in the morning. He sealed it. He wrote her London address on the front, the office address from the documents she had left behind, the ones he had read and reread more times than he would have admitted to anyone. Then he sat back and looked at what he had written on the outside of the envelope. Miss C. Voss. He did not know what the C stood for. He had never asked. He thought about that for a moment, about how many things he had not asked, and how many things she had not offered, and how the balance of information between them had been, from the very first minute, entirely in her favor. He had let her stand in his study for 4 minutes. He had not offered her a chair. He pressed his seal into the wax and told himself that, in the morning, when it was a reasonable hour, he would send for his fastest rider. He did not wait for morning. He rang for the night footman at 4:15 and handed over the letter with instructions that it leave for London before dawn. Then he went back to the desk and sat with his father's ledgers until the light came up gray and slow through the east window, and the house began to stir around him, and the fire was rebuilt by hands that did not know what he had been reading all night. He did not sleep. He was not sure he could have, even if he'd tried. The letter arrived at Cecily's London office on a Wednesday morning, carried by a rider who had clearly not stopped for anything resembling a proper night's sleep, and who accepted the glass of water her assistant offered him with the gratitude of a man who had been running on determination alone for the better part of 12 hours. Cecily was in a meeting when it arrived. She knew it was from Ashworth before she opened it. She recognized the seal, and there was something about the handwriting on the outside of the envelope that was different from the note he had sent to the inn. That had been hasty, almost impulsive. This was different. The letters were formed with the careful deliberateness of someone who had written and rewritten and was still not entirely satisfied. She set it on the corner of her desk and finished the meeting. It took 40 minutes. She was aware of the envelope for all 40 of them. When the last of her associates had filed out and the door had closed and the room was quiet, she picked it up, broke the seal, and read it. Then she read it again. Then she set it down, stood up, walked to the window and looked out at the street below, the carts and the pedestrians and the gray London morning going about its business with total indifference for a very long time. He had found the ledgers. He had not said so explicitly. She suspected he was not a man who found explicit admissions easy, but it was there in every careful sentence, in the particular quality of the language, which was formal in the way that people are formal when they are trying to hold themselves steady around something that has genuinely shaken them. He wrote about the estate's history. He wrote about his father. He wrote with a precision that told her he had looked at the actual figures rather than relying on what he'd been told, about the financial arrangements of the 1840s and their consequences. He did not say, "I know what my father did to yours." He said, "I have recently come to understand that the history between our families is more complex than I was previously aware, and that Ashworth bears a debt that has never been properly acknowledged, let alone addressed." It was, she thought, a remarkably careful way of saying something that must have cost him considerably to discover. He went on. He wrote about the ball briefly, with a self-awareness that surprised her, acknowledging that it had been a miscalculation, that pursuing a conventional solution and a serious financial arrangement simultaneously was neither honest nor practical, and he should not have attempted both. He did not apologize for the ball exactly, but he came close enough that she could see the shape of the apology even where the words stopped short of it. And then near the end, after 3 pages of careful and deliberate and controlled prose, the handwriting changed, just slightly, just enough. "Miss Voss, I find I have a great many questions that I should have asked when you were here and did not, and I am aware that this is entirely my own failing. I am also aware that I have given you very little reason to return. I am asking you to return regardless. There are matters to discuss that go beyond the financial arrangements, and I would prefer to discuss them in person, if you are willing. I realize I am asking a great deal. I realize also that I did not offer you a chair." That last line. She read it 4 times. It was so small a thing to put in a letter, so oddly specific, and yet it was, she thought, the most honest sentence in 3 pages of careful honesty, because it meant he had been thinking about it. It meant that of all the things he had gotten wrong in their first meeting, that was the one that had stayed with him. Not the figures, not the assumptions about who she was and what she was worth. The chair. She folded the letter and put it in the inner pocket of her case, next to her father's journal. She stood at the window for another few minutes. Then she went back to her desk and began to work through the rest of her correspondence, and she did not let herself think about the letter again for the remainder of the morning. She thought about it all afternoon. The work did not suffer, Cecily had learned, over years of conducting business in rooms where she was frequently underestimated, to keep the surface of her attention entirely professional, while the deeper part of her mind ran its own separate calculations. She met with 2 prospective clients, reviewed a contract that needed revision, wrote 3 letters and approved 4 more, and at no point did anyone in her office observe anything other than complete composure. Inside, she was having an argument with herself. The practical part of her, the part that had rebuilt the Voss name from nothing, the part that had bought Hartwell and Sons and identified the Ashworth connection and made the trip to the estate and conducted 2 extremely careful meetings without revealing more than was strategically useful, that part said, "You have done what Father asked. You went. You gave him a chance. He wasted it by going behind you to find a wife at a ball. You have other investments, better prospects, and no obligation to go back." The other part, the part she was less comfortable with, the part that had noticed him standing when she left, the part that had read, "I did not offer you a chair 4 times," that part said something considerably less practical, and she was not quite ready to examine it directly. She stayed late at the office. She walked home rather than taking a carriage, because the cold air helped, and because London at dusk had a quality of anonymity she found useful when she needed to think without being seen to think. By the time she reached her house, she had made no decision. By the time she had eaten supper and sat down by the fire with her father's journal open in her lap, she was still making no decision. She read her father's 2 lines. "Ashworth took everything. Give his son a chance anyway." She closed the journal. "I gave him a chance," she said to no one, to the fire, to her father who was not there. The fire said nothing useful. She went to bed and did not sleep well and woke before dawn with the uncomfortable clarity that sometimes arrives in the early morning hours when the mind has been working while the body rested. The clarity that cuts through all the practical arguments and the careful calculations and arrives at the thing you have been trying not to say. She wanted to go back. Not for the investment, not for the ledgers, not for any of the careful, legitimate, professionally defensible reasons she had assembled over the past weeks like a wall around something more inconvenient. She wanted to go back because a man who had let her stand in his study for 4 minutes had spent what was apparently most of a night reading his father's old accounts, and had written her a letter at 4 in the morning, and had thought of everything, of all of it, to mention the chair. She got up. She dressed. She went to her desk before the rest of the household was awake and wrote a reply that was considerably shorter than his letter. She was not ready yet to match him for honesty, but she could gesture toward it. "Your Grace, I have received your letter and read it carefully. I will be in Ashworth on Friday. I trust that is sufficient notice. See Voss asterisk." She had never signed with her initial before. She was not entirely sure why she did it now. She sent it before she could reconsider, then spent the rest of the morning wondering if he would notice. She arrived on Friday afternoon to find that it had rained for 2 days straight, and the roads out of the village were in a condition that her driver described as "navigable, madam, if we're being generous." The inn welcomed her back with the same lack of ceremony it had shown the first time, and Mrs. Aldgate, who was apparently a permanent feature of the establishment, expressed delight at her return and immediately began to ask questions that Cecily answered with a pleasantness specifically designed to provide no information whatsoever. She had sent no word to the house about her arrival time. She had not, in fact, sent any word to the house beyond her initial reply, which meant the Duke knew she was coming on Friday and nothing else. Not which coach, not what hour, not where she was staying, though the Hart and Crown was the only reasonable option, and she suspected he was not without the capacity to deduce it. She was proved right on Saturday morning when a note arrived with breakfast, in handwriting she now recognized immediately. "Miss Voss, I should like to call on you this morning if you are willing to receive me. I am aware this is unconventional. I find I am less concerned with convention than I was a month ago. Ashworth asterisk." Cecily read it over her toast. less concerned with convention than I was a month ago. She thought about what it had cost him to write that, a duke, in a village where every curtain twitched and every arrival was noted, and the concept of a private life was largely theoretical. She thought about what it meant that he was proposing to come to her rather than summoning her to the house again. She picked up her pen. "Your Grace, 10 o'clock, V." She put her father's journal in her pocket. She was not sure why. She did not intend to show it to him, but it felt important to have it there, some solid, specific reminder of why she had come, and what she owed and what she did not owe, and where the line between them was. She was still trying to locate that line precisely when she heard the carriage on the road outside at 9:55, and then, a moment later, a commotion in the yard that was not the sound of a carriage arriving smoothly. She went to the window. The Duke of Ashworth's carriage had come to a halt at an angle that suggested at least one wheel had found the deep rut that ran across the inn yard, a rut that had been there for as long as Cecily had been staying there, and that she had learned to step around without thinking. The carriage was listing slightly to the left. The driver was down from the box and looking at the situation with the expression of a man calculating how long it would take to resolve it. The horses were objecting, moderately but persistently, to being stationary at an inconvenient angle. And the Duke of Ashworth had climbed down from the carriage himself, and was standing in the inn yard in what was, even from the window, clearly a quantity of mud that had not been there when he left the house. He was looking at his boots. Then he looked up, with the expression of a man who suspects he is being observed, and found Cecily at the window. She should not have smiled. She knew she should not have smiled. She smiled. He looked at her for a moment. Then he looked back at his boots. Then he said something to his driver that she could not hear through the glass, and he walked toward the inn's front door with the particular dignity of a man who has decided that dignity is the only thing left available to him, and he will deploy it regardless of circumstances. She met him in the small sitting room. He was up close, even muddier than he had appeared from the window. It was not just the boots. There was a quantity of it on the hem of his coat as well, and he was holding his hat in a way that suggested he was very aware of how he looked and had made a decision to simply proceed anyway. "Miss Voss," he said. "Your Grace," she said, with a composure she was rather proud of. He looked at her. There was something different about his face from the man she had met a month ago. Not the mud, not the hat, something in the eyes, which were steadier and less defended, and carrying the particular quality of someone who has been awake with difficult information long enough that the pretense of not knowing it is no longer available to him. "I owe you an apology," he said. "Several, in fact. I intend to make them. I would ask that you hear me out before you respond, because I have a great deal to say and I am not entirely confident I will manage it well if I'm interrupted." Cecily looked at him for a long moment. Then she gestured to the chair across from hers. "Sit down," she said, "please." Something moved across his face at that, at the word "please," or at the gesture, or at the specific memory she suspected they were both having simultaneously. He sat. She sat. And for the first time since she had walked into his study and stood unreceived for 4 minutes, they were on precisely the same level, two people in a small room, with no desk between them and no pretense of who held the advantage, and a great deal that needed to be said. He began to speak. He spoke for a long time. Cecily had asked him not to be interrupted, and she honored that, sitting with her hands folded in her lap, and her expression composed, and her attention entirely, completely his, which she suspected was itself an unfamiliar experience for him, being listened to by someone who was not doing so out of obligation or deference, but out of genuine, careful attention. He began with the ledgers. He told her what he had found, and when, and how the night of the ball, the brandy he hadn't touched, the cold coming in from the window corner, the note in his father's handwriting tucked into the back cover of the fourth book. He was precise about the figures, which told her he had gone back and looked at them more than once. He was precise about the timeline, the original lending, the extensions, the way the capital had been absorbed into ventures that failed, the way the name Voss had simply disappeared from the accounting in the years after his father's death, slipping out of the record as cleanly as if it had never been there. He did not make excuses for his father. She had half expected him to had braced herself slightly for the particular kind of loyalty that makes men defend the indefensible out of love for someone they have lost. But he didn't. He sat in the chair she had offered him in his muddy coat with his hat in his hands, and he said, with the flatness of someone stating a fact rather than offering an opinion, "My father borrowed against your father's trust and never made it right." "I don't know if it was deliberate. I don't think it was. I don't think it matters." Cecily said nothing. "What matters," he said, "is that it happened, and that no one, including me until 4 days ago, had any idea that it had." He paused. "I want to correct that." "How?" she said. It was the first word she had spoken since he started. He looked at her directly. "However you tell me I should." That was not the answer she had expected. She had expected an offer, a figure, a repayment plan, some formal financial mechanism that would allow both of them to treat the whole thing as a transaction and walk away from it cleanly. She had, if she was honest, been preparing her response to exactly that kind of offer for the past 3 days, because it was the kind of offer she knew how to handle. This was not that. She looked at him for a long moment. He held the look without flinching, which she noted, because the men who had something to be ashamed of usually didn't. "There is more," he said. "I assumed there was," she said. He set his hat down on the table beside his chair, the first time he'd put it down since he sat, which meant his hands were now free, which meant he was no longer managing anything. She noticed all of it. She had always noticed all of it with him, from the very first meeting that had been the problem. "The ball," he said. "You don't need to." "I do," he said, with a quiet firmness that stopped her. "I was pursuing two things at once and pretending to myself that they were separate. They were not separate. I was sitting across from a woman who was serious and capable and who had come, as I now understand, at some personal cost, for reasons I had not begun to guess at, and I was simultaneously attempting to solve my problems in the most conventional and least demanding way available to me." He paused. It was cowardly. "I don't have a better word for it." Cecily was quiet for a moment. Outside, she could hear the inn yard, the sound of the carriage being sorted, the horses resettled, her driver exchanging pleasantries with someone she couldn't identify. "You had your reasons," she said finally, because she was not, despite everything, an unfair person. "I had my habits," he said. "That's different." She looked at him. He looked back. There was something happening in the room that was not about ledgers or investments or the complicated inheritance of other people's failures, and they were both aware of it, and neither of them was quite ready to name it. And so they sat with it for a moment in the way that two careful people sit with something they are not yet sure how to hold. "My father left me a note," Cecily said. She had not planned to say it. It came out with the directness that things sometimes do when you have been holding them for a long time, and the moment finally arrives when they simply will not stay held. He was very still. She reached into her pocket and took out the journal. She did not open it. She held it in both hands, looking at it, and she told him, for the first time, to anyone outside her own household, what was written on the inside cover, not the words exactly, the meaning. "He knew what your father had done," she said, "or he knew enough. He was not a man who held grudges. It was one of the things that frustrated me most about him when I was young and considerably more certain about how the world ought to work. She turned the journal over in her hands. He said to give his son a chance. Those were his words. Give his son a chance. She looked up. That is why I came, she said. Not for the investment, not for the money. I have enough money. I came because my father asked me to and because I had spent 15 years being angry on his behalf and I thought, she stopped, started again. I thought perhaps he was right, that it was worth finding out. The Duke was quiet for a long time. When he spoke, his voice was different from any register she had heard from him before. Not the controlled smoothness of the first meeting, not the careful deliberateness of the letter. Something simpler than either. What did you find out? He said. Cecily considered the question with the seriousness it deserved. That you didn't offer me a chair, she said. Something crossed his face, the beginning of something that was not quite a smile and was not quite pain and was somewhere in the complicated territory between them. Yes. And that you stood when I left. He stopped. I didn't realize you had noticed that. I notice everything, she said, which was true, and which she had not intended to say quite so plainly, but which, once said, she did not regret. He was quiet again. Then, I have been going over our meetings in my mind, all of them. He paused, and she could see him selecting his words with the care of a man who is trying to be honest, and is finding it uncomfortable in the specific way that honesty is uncomfortable when it is new. Considerably more interested in your opinion of me than is entirely dignified, Miss Voss. I thought you should know that. Cecily looked at him. She thought about her father, who had trusted a duke and lost everything and still found it in himself to say, give his son a chance. She thought about the writer who had left Ashworth before dawn, with a letter that said, I did not offer you a chair. She thought about the inn yard, and the mud, and the dignity deployed regardless of circumstances. Cecily, she said. He blinked. My name, she said. You wrote Miss C. Voss on your letter. The C is for Cecily. She held his gaze. I thought you should know that. The expression on his face in that moment was one she thought she might keep, privately, for a very long time. Cecily, he said, as though he was testing the weight of it. Don't make it strange, she said. He almost smiled. It was, she thought, a very good almost smile. It did something to the whole composition of his face, loosened it, made it younger, made it look more like the face of a man than the face of a title. Callum, he said. She said nothing. Fair exchange, he said. I'll consider it, she said, which made the almost smile become an actual one. And that was considerably more dangerous than the almost had been. They talked for 2 hours. Not about the investment, not directly, not yet. They talked around it and through it and occasionally in spite of it, in the way that two people talk when they have been conducting a conversation on one level and are beginning, carefully, to admit that there is another level running underneath it. He asked about her work. Not with the polite incomprehension she was accustomed to from men of his position, but with genuine curiosity, the specific questions of someone who wanted to understand the mechanics of something rather than simply acknowledge its existence. How had she started? What was the Hartwell acquisition? And why? Did she manage everything herself, or did she have partners she trusted? She told him, more than she had intended to tell him. She found that his questions were good questions, which was the most reliable indicator she knew of an intelligent mind, not the quality of what a person said, but the quality of what they asked. In return, she asked him about the estate, not the finances, she knew the finances, but the place itself. How long had he lived here, and where else had he been, and what did he actually want for it, separate from what he needed? It was a distinction she had found useful in business. What someone wanted and what they needed were frequently different things, and the gap between them was usually where the real conversation lived. He was quiet for a moment when she asked it. "I wanted to survive," he said finally. "Not for me. I want..." He stopped. She waited. "My grandmother planted the kitchen garden. She planted it the year she married into the family, and she tended it herself for 40 years. It is still there. It is the best thing on the property." He looked slightly surprised at himself for saying it. "I want the things people built here to outlast the mistakes made here. I think that is what I want." Cecily thought of her father's journal, of two lines of careful handwriting that had outlasted everything. "That seems like enough to want," she said. He looked at her with an expression she was beginning to recognize, the particular look of a man who has said something he didn't plan to and has found, unexpectedly, that it has been received without judgment. "You are not what I expected," he said. "When Prynne's letter said there was an interested investor, you are not." "A man," she said pleasantly. "No," he shook his head. "I was going to say, you are not what I expected a person to be, generally." She looked at him for a moment. "Nor are you," she said. It was past noon when the conversation found its natural pause, the kind of pause that arrives not because there is nothing left to say, but because both people have reached the same moment of needing to set down what they have been carrying and simply breathe. Cecily refilled her own tea. She had stopped waiting for anyone to do it for her approximately 20 years ago. The Duke watched her do it with an expression she could not quite read. "I have been thinking," he said, "about what an appropriate arrangement might look like between Ashworth and your interests." "Have you?" she said. "The financial terms you outlined in your document," he said. "I should like to revisit them, not to renegotiate, to honor them properly with full disclosure of the estate's actual position, which I should have given you in the first meeting." "You should have," she agreed. "I should also like..." He stopped. He was doing the thing again where he selected words with great care, and she found she had stopped finding it annoying and had started finding it something else entirely, something she was not examining directly. "There is a formal component to any arrangement of this kind, a social component. It would be..." He chose the next word with particular deliberateness, "appropriate for an investor of your standing to be known as such, publicly. I should like to make that possible, if you are willing." Cecily set down her teacup. "You want to tell people," she said, "that a woman is your primary investor." "I want to tell people," he said, "that Cecily Voss is my primary investor, yes." She heard the difference. She thought he intended her to hear it. "There will be talk," she said. "There is always talk," he said, with the first hint of genuine wryness she had heard from him. "I have found that worrying about it in advance does not reduce the quantity." She looked at him steadily, and the other solution, the conventional one. He met her gaze without hesitation. "There is no other solution," he said. "There is only this one. I should have understood that earlier." The room was quiet. Outside, the inn yard had settled. The carriage had been sorted. The horses were still. London felt very far away, and the week after next, when she was supposed to be meeting with a shipping consortium in Bristol, felt suddenly theoretical. "I will need to return to London first," she said. "Of course. There are arrangements to finalize. Legal documents that will require Mr. Prynne's involvement and his opinion, which he will give me at length whether I ask for it or not." "Naturally. And I will need access to the estate's full accounts, not the version prepared for external presentation, the actual accounts." "You will have them." "All of them," she said, "including the historical ones." Something moved in his expression at that, a recognition of what she was asking and why. "Including those," he said quietly. She nodded. She stood. He stood too, immediately, without hesitation, as if it were the most natural thing he had ever done. And perhaps for him it was, she could not know, but it was different from the automatic courtesy of that first meeting, the reflex of a man following a rule he had been given. This was something else. This was a man choosing to stand. She picked up her case. She picked up her father's journal from the table where she had set it, and put it back in her pocket, and felt the familiar weight of it settle against her. She looked at him. "Callum," she said, trying it. He was very still. It was not strange at all. "There is one more thing," she said. "Yes." "When I come back," she said, and she held his gaze and made sure he understood she meant it as she said it. "When, not if, I will walk through the front door." He looked at her for a moment. "Yes," he said, and his voice had gone quiet in a way that was not distance but the opposite of it. "You will, and someone will be there to open it." She nodded once. She walked to the door of the sitting room. She stopped. She did not turn around. "The kitchen garden," she said, "your grandmother's." "Yes." "I should like to see it," she said, "when I come back." A pause, brief, but she could feel the quality of it even with her back turned. "It will be waiting," he said. She walked out of the inn into the thin November afternoon, and the cold hit her face, and she stood for a moment in the yard with her case in her hand and her father's journal in her pocket, and the sound of the road busy with ordinary life going past the gate. She did not allow herself to smile until she was inside the carriage. Then she allowed herself to smile for a considerable time. 1 year later, the kitchen garden at Ashworth was best in October. Cecily had learned this gradually, over 4 seasons of visiting it, first with the head gardener, who had shown her around with the cautious pride of a man introducing something he loved to someone he wasn't sure yet. And then alone, in the early mornings before the house was fully awake, when the light came low and golden through the espaliered pear trees, and the air smelled of turned earth and the last of the autumn herbs. She had a favorite corner, the south-facing wall, where her grandmother-in-law had planted a climbing rose that had no business surviving an English winter and had been surviving them defiantly for 40 years. It was finished for the season now, bare-stemmed, thorny, already retreating into itself for the cold months ahead. She stood beside it with her morning tea and thought, as she sometimes did, about the women who had stood in this same spot before her. She heard him before she saw him, the particular sound of his footsteps on the gravel path, unhurried, familiar. "You're up early," Callum said. "I'm always up early," she said. "You know this." "I know it," he said, coming to stand beside her. "I remain baffled by it." She handed him her tea without looking at him. He took it without comment, which was one of the things she had learned about him this year, that he received small kindnesses with a naturalness that had taken her longer than she expected to stop finding surprising. He had not been raised to expect kindness, particularly. He had simply, quietly, learned to welcome it. "The Prynne letter came yesterday," she said. "The Bristol Consortium has finalized the documents." "I know, Fellows told me." "Fellows should mind his own correspondence." "Fellows minds all correspondence. It's why we keep him." He handed her tea back. "Is it what you wanted?" "Better," she said. "It's better than what I wanted." She paused. The Ashworth figures were the thing that convinced them in the end, the recovery in the eastern fields. They said it demonstrated. "Cecily." She stopped. "I know," he said, with great patience and no little warmth. "You told me on Tuesday, and on Wednesday briefly and again at dinner on Thursday." She looked at him. "You could simply tell me when you've already heard something." "I could," he agreed. "I find I don't mind hearing it again." She looked away before he could see what her face did at that. The garden was quiet around them, the good quiet of early morning, the quiet of a place that was alive and resting rather than empty. Somewhere in the kitchen wing, she could hear the beginning of the household waking, the distant clatter of the first fires being laid, the sound of the side door, a voice she recognized as the housekeeper's carrying through the still air. "Mrs. Hartley is going to want us inside for breakfast in 20 minutes," Cecily said. "Mrs. Hartley wants us inside for breakfast every morning," he said. "We are never inside for breakfast in 20 minutes. "We should try." "We should," he agreed, making no movement whatsoever toward going inside. They stood in companionable silence for a moment, looking at the garden. "I was thinking," Cecily said, "about adding a section here, along the north wall. There's enough space if we move the cold frames back for whatever you want to put there," he said. She glanced at him. "It's your garden now, too," he said simply. "Whatever you want to put in it." She looked at the north wall. She thought about her grandmother, the woman she had never met, who had planted a climbing rose that had no business surviving and given it 40 years to prove itself, and who had been right to do so. She thought about her father's journal, which was upstairs in her writing desk now, no longer in her pocket, no longer something she needed to carry. She had read his 2 lines so many times that they had worn themselves smooth in her memory, familiar as her own name. "Ashworth took everything. Give his son a chance anyway." She had given him a chance. She thought her father would have found the outcome satisfactory. She thought he would have liked the kitchen garden, specifically. He had always liked gardens, had grown things in pots on the windowsill of the little house they'd had after the money was gone, herbs mostly, and one determinedly optimistic lemon tree that had never produced a lemon but had lived for 15 years regardless, which her father had considered a victory. She would tell Callum about the lemon tree. She hadn't yet. There was still so much she hadn't told him, so many small specific things that made up the texture of who she was, the way small specific things do, the accumulated details that a person becomes. She was telling them to him gradually, one at a time, and he received each one with the same quiet attention he gave everything, and she found that she had stopped being surprised by it and started simply being grateful for it. "Callum," she said.
"Him."
"The first time I came here," she said, "to Ashworth, the very first day."
He waited.
"I stood in your study for 4 minutes," she said. "I know," he said. There was something in his voice, not quite guilt, not quite apology, something that had moved past both of those into a place that was quieter and more settled. "I know. I have thought about it more times than I will tell you." "I sat down anyway," she said, "without being asked."
"You did."
"I want you to know," she said, "that I would do it again. Now, knowing everything," she paused. "I would walk through that door and sit down in that chair and wait for you to look up. I would do it again." He was quiet for a moment. Then he reached over, without ceremony, and took her hand where it rested on the garden wall. She let him. They stood there in the October garden, in the good morning light, in the place his grandmother had made something lasting out of ordinary ground. And the house breathed around them, and the rose thorns caught the low sun, and below them the valley was waking up in the slow, unhurried way of countryside that has been waking up the same way for centuries and intends to continue. "Come inside," he said eventually. "Mrs. Hartley."
"Yes," she said.
Neither of them moved for another few minutes. When they finally walked back up the path toward the house, he opened the garden gate and held it, an unnecessary courtesy, a small one, the kind of thing that is easy to stop noticing when it happens every day. Cecily noticed it every day. She intended to go on noticing it. In the front hall of Ashworth House, just to the right of the main entrance, there is a chair that was not there before. It is not a grand chair, not one of the formal pieces from the drawing room. It is a good chair, solid and comfortable, placed where the light comes in well from the east window in the mornings. No one put a sign on it. No one needed to.
It was simply there, from one day to the next, in the spot where a woman had once been left standing for 4 minutes by a man who knew better and had not, yet, been better. He was better now. She had given him the chance to be. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.